Chapter 108 was in severe motion. The steward, the Honorable G. Ringwood, passes reeling by, holding six basins. He puts one rapidly by Lord Squeam's Lady Squeam's, giving a pinch to her dog, which begins to howl piteously, puts her pocket handkerchief to her face, and rushes away as for the cabin. The music rises up to the wildest pitch of stormy excitement, and the third syllable is concluded. There was a little ballet, or a signal, in which Montesu and Noblet used to be famous in those days, and which Mr. Wag transferred to the English stage as an opera, putting his verse, of which he was a skillful writer, to the pretty airs of the ballet. It was dressed in old French costume, and little Lord Southdown now appeared admirably attired in the disguise of an old woman hobbling about the stage with a faultless crooked stick. Trills of melody were heard behind the scenes, and gurgling from a sweet pasteboard cottage covered with roses and trellis work. "Philomel, Philomel," cries the old woman, and Philomel comes out. More applause it is Mrs. Rawdon Crawley in powder and patches, the most reviscent little marquise in the world. She comes in laughing, humming, and frisks about the stage with all the innocence of theatrical youth. She makes a curtsy. Mama says, "Why, child, you are always laughing and singing," and away she goes, with "the rose upon my balcony, the rose upon my balcony, the morning air perfuming was leafless all the winter time and pining for the spring. You ask me why her breath is sweet, and why her cheek is blooming, it is because the sun is out and birds begin to sing." The nightingale, whose melody is through the green wood ringing, was silent when the boughs were bare, and winds were blowing keen. "And if, Mama, you ask of me the reason of his singing, it is because the sun is out, and all the leaves are green." Thus each performs his part. "Mama, the birds have found their voices, the blowing rose a flush. Mama, her bonny cheek to die, and there's sunshine in my heart. Mama, which wakens and rejoices, and so I sing and blush. Mama, and that's the reason why." During the intervals of the stanzas of this ditty, the good-natured personage addressed as Mama by the singer, and whose large whiskers appeared under her cap, seemed very anxious to exhibit her maternal affection by embracing the innocent creature who performed the daughter's part. Every caress was received with loud acclamations of laughter by the sympathizing audience. At its conclusion, while the music was performing a symphony, as if ever so many birds were warbling, the whole house was unanimous for an encore. And applause and bouquets without end were showered upon the nightingale of the evening. Lord Stang's voice of applause was loudest of all. Becky, the nightingale, took the flowers which he threw to her, and pressed them to her heart with the air of a consummate comedian. Lord Stang was frantic with delight. His guest's enthusiasm harmonized with his own. Where was the beautiful black-eyed houri whose appearance in the first charade had caused such delight? She was twice as handsome as Becky, but the brilliance eye of the latter had quite eclipsed her. All voices were for her. Stevens, Caradori, Ronzi de Begnis, people compared her to one or the other, and agreed with good reason, very likely, that had she been an actress none on the stage could have surpassed her. As he had reached her culmination. Her voice rose trilling and bright over the storm of applause, and soared as high and joyful as her triumph. There was a ball after the dramatic entertainments, and everybody pressed round Becky as the great point of attraction of the evening. The royal personage declared with an oath that she was perfection, and engaged her again and again in conversation. Little Becky's soul swelled with pride and delight at these honors. She saw fortune, fame, fashion before her. Lord Stang was her slave, followed her everywhere, and scarcely spoke to anyone in the room beside, and paid her the most marked compliments and attention. She still appeared in her marquise costume, and danced a minuet with Monsieur de Truffigny, Monsieur le Duc de la Jabotiere's attaché, and the Duke, who had all the traditions of the ancient court, pronounced that Madame Crawley was worthy to have been a pupil of Estrus, or to have figured at Versailles. Only a feeling of dignity, the gout, and the strongest sense of duty and personal sacrifice prevented His Excellency from dancing with her himself, and he declared in public that a lady who could talk and dance like Mrs. Rawdon was fit to be ambassadress at any court in Europe. He was only consoled when he heard that she was half a Frenchwoman by birth. One but a compatriot, His Excellency declared, could have performed that majestic dance in such a way. Then she figured in a waltz with Monsieur de Klingenspor, the Prince of Peterwaradin's cousin and attaché. The delighted prince, having less retenue than his French diplomatic colleague, insisted upon taking a turn with the charming creature, and twirled round the ballroom with her, scattering the diamonds out of his boot tassels and hussar jacket until His Highness was fairly out of breath. Papoosh Pasha himself would have liked to dance with her, if that amusement had been the custom of his country. The company made a circle round her, and applauded as wildly as if he had been a noblet or a taglioni. Everybody was in ecstasy, and Becky too, you may be sure. She passed by Lady Stunnington with a look of scorn. She patronized Lady Gaunt and her astonished and mortified sister-in-law Shiekrist, all rival charmers. As for poor Mrs. Winkworth, and her long hair and great eyes, which had made such an effect at the commencement of the evening, where was she now? Nowhere in the race. She might tear her long hair, and cry her great eyes out, but there was not a person to heed, or to deplore the discomfiture. The greatest triumph of all was at supper time. She was placed at the grand exclusive table with His Royal Highness the exalted personage before mentioned, and the rest of the great guests. She was served on gold plate. She might have had pearls melted into her champagne, if she liked another Cleopatra, and the potentate of Peterwaradin would have given half the brilliance off his jacket for a kind glance from those dazzling eyes. Jabotier wrote home about her to his government. The ladies at the other tables, who supped off mere silver and marked Lord Steyne's constant attention to her, vowed it was a monstrous infatuation, a gross insult to ladies of rank. If sarcasm could have killed, Lady Stunnington would have slain her on the spot. Rawdon Crawley was scared at these triumphs. They seemed to separate his wife farther than ever from him somehow. He thought with a feeling very like pain, how immeasurably she was his superior. When the hour of departure came, a crowd of young men followed her to her carriage, for which the people without bawled, the cry being caught up by the linkmen who were stationed outside the tall gates of Gaunt House, congratulating each person who issued from the gate, and hoping his lordship had enjoyed this noble party. Mrs. Rawdon Crawley's carriage, coming up to the gate after due shouting, rattled into the illuminated courtyard, and drove up to the covered way. Rawdon put his wife into the carriage, which drove off. Mr. Wenham had proposed to him to walk home, and offered the colonel the refreshment of a cigar. They lighted their cigars by the lamp of one of the many link boys outside, and Rawdon walked on with his friend Wenham. Two persons separated from the crowd, and followed the two gentlemen, and when they had walked down Gaunt Square a few score of paces, one of the men came up, and, touching Rawdon on the shoulder, said, "Beg your pardon, Colonel, I wish to speak to you most particular." This gentleman's acquaintance gave a loud whistle as the latter spoke, at which signal a cab came clattering up from those stationed at the gate of Gaunt House, and the aide-de-camp ran round and placed himself in front of Colonel Crawley. That gallant officer at once knew what had befallen him. He was in the hands of the bailiffs. He started back, falling against the man who had first touched him. "We're three on us, it's no use bolting," the man behind said. "It's you, Moss, is it?" said the colonel, who appeared to know his interlocutor. "How much is it?" "Only a small thing," whispered Mr. Moss, of Cursitor Street, Chancery Lane, and assistant officer to the Sheriff of Middlesex, 166, 6 8 pence, at the suit of Mr. Nathan. "Lend me 100, Wenham, for God's sake," poor Rawdon said, "I've got 70 at home." I've not got 10 pounds in the world, said poor Mr. Wenamoot Knight, my dear fellow. Good night, said Rodden ruefully. And Wenham walked away, and Rodden Crawley finished his cigar as the cab drove under Temple Bar. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.